I got up early today to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That's a good way to start your day.
Yeah.
Not anxiety inducing at all. I'm sure.
Like, I didn't want to do it at night.
Oh, you think you'd be too freaked out?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Pre-Dead Media Corner. It's been a while. We haven't done this in a while, Max.
I know.
This is a bonus podcast where your pre-dead boys, that's me, Dorian, and Max over here.
Hello.
We give a death positive perspective on movies, books, music, games, other creative works that we are consuming ravenously all of the time.
Gulping down, just like that Pokemon gulping.
I have not paid attention to Pokemon for many years now, so
you know,
I don't get the reference.
You know Gulpin, because Gulpin is the green guy in Super Smash who you throw out, and he comes out of the Pokeball, and then if you walk near him, he swallows you and you take damage. I think it's maybe only in Brawl.
Oh, well, we're not going to talk about Smash, unfortunately. fortunately, we are going to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, but first of all, why are we doing this bonus episode? Well, number one...
So we can hang out more?
Yeah, just an excuse for us to hang out and talk about things that interest us. So this is just me and Max hanging out. You're lucky.
That's the only reason I'm doing it. I don't know if you're doing it for another reason.
Well, another reason that we're doing this is that this coincides with the upcoming release of our Patreon. For those who don't know, Patreon is a platform where you, the listener, pitch in some cash each month and we give you bonus goodies. And basically you help us sustain the work that we are putting into creating this podcast.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, our podcast is going to be free as planned, as scheduled. Every 2 weeks, we're going to come out with a new episode.
Yep.
Free of charge. You don't have to pay for that ever. However,
it's a pre-dead pledge.
We would like, if you are someone who loves the podcast and you want to help us continue to make it and play a part in creating this, we're going to launch Patreon, and we're going to release some bonus episodes and bonus content. So consider this episode a little bit of a taste of what's to come when we finally launch that Patreon in the month of November.
Yeah.
So that's coming up. Keep your eyes and ears
and ears.
Browsers peeled for that.
Just in time for a tax-deductible donation.
Exactly. So what are we talking about today? Not Smash Brothers,
no.
But we are going to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I really like that you're emphasizing the space there.
Yes.
Between chain and saw.
Yes. Yeah, so the original submission for the name was The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. However, it was stylized chainsaw in a lot of promotional materials, especially in North America, but it is registered in like the England film or like the UK film registry or something as Chainsaw. And I feel personally like that helps distinguish the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre from the somewhat mediocre remake that came out in the 2000s. Which
didn't see it.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about it. It's not bad, but it's definitely got some parts that are freaky. But we're talking about the good shit, the original shit. Came out in 1974, was directed by Tobe Hooper. A few little quick facts about it. It is notorious for having a brutal shooting period in 100 degree and more weather in Texas. It was shot on a budget of $60,000. And just by contrast, Halloween, the John Carpenter original, came out 4 years later. It was created with a budget of about $300,000.
So five times as much?
So five times as much to make Halloween, which was considered a pretty low budget movie.
Yeah, it's just houses and like first person.
Right.
Camera work, you know?
Right. Texas Chainsaw Massacre had an opening week of somewhere between $5 and $10 million, which is really successful for a movie by today's standards. Back then, it was mind-blowing. The most recent box office estimations are about $30.9 million. So this was an incredibly successful movie. It's one of the most famous, notorious horror films of all time. Max, this is your first time seeing it.
Yes.
Was 7 o'clock this morning to start your day with a jarring horror film. Without giving any spoilers and just kind of broad strokes, what did you think of the movie and what do you see as like the appeal of it? Why do you think it was such a successful movie?
So I had never seen the movie before. When it comes to horror, I'm nowhere near as into it as you are. True. You know? And I've never been a big fan of, like, the whole slasher genre. Like, right. I've never seen Friday the 13th. I have seen, like, Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and stuff like that. But if I'm watching horror, I'm usually going for more, like, maybe psychological stuff.
Okay.
I think is the better thing. I like Hitchcock a lot. I think maybe that's what kind of does it for me, is I really like Hitchcock's view of horror as, like, the underbelly of things. And something I was really... So I did watch it at 7 a.m. this morning. Because, like, I've heard people watch the movie before.
Uh-huh.
Like, I've been around while people are watching the movie, and I'm like, boy, these noises are very difficult to listen to. And it, like, my day usually wraps up at, like, 9 or so. And I was like, I don't want to have to deal with those noises at, like, 10 at night. That sounds difficult.
Yeah. It's freaky.
Yeah. So I watched it in the morning and then went to work. Because I can start my work day kind of late. But I enjoyed it. I was actually really impressed by some of the things that you had talked to me about that I think we're going to talk about in this episode and have me look out for.
Mm-hmm.
I was weirded out and want to talk about the parts of the movie that made me laugh.
Okay. Yeah.
The part of the movie that made me laugh.
Okay.
I'm
curious what that is, but we'll get into that soon.
Yeah. It is really interesting, and I think it's going to be really interesting for us to talk about this kind of in a way that's not like how I feel like a lot of people probably talk about a movie like this, which is like probably the start of, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this movie probably gets credited as like the start of like torture porn and gore porn and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, this definitely has a reputation of like one of the most violent movies of all time. It was banned in various places when it came out. When it was released, people were allegedly like throwing up in the theater and wanted their money back, and it was censored in England until 2000.
Really?
Yeah. So it has a reputation of being this like shocking, exploitative piece of work, but yeah, I don't know. Did you get that vibe from it when you watched it?
I mean, I could definitely see where that would come from, but I think being primed to view it in a way that is not that, you know?
Yeah.
In a way that's not like, I love seeing people get cut open. Right. Yeah, you know? And I think if you've never seen the movie before and you're kind of like on the fence about it, like I was, I would encourage you to listen to this and then watch the movie with, I think, probably the view towards it that we're going to talk about. And I wonder if it'll kind of open it up a little bit to you.
Yeah. Because
I was really intrigued by it. Will I ever watch it again? Maybe not. But yeah. I'm very interested in it now.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So before we get into the spoiler territory, I feel like if you recommend a horror movie, then that's pretty glowing praise. Yeah. If I do, it's just kind of, yeah, Dorian saw a horror movie, of course he would recommend it. But yeah, it's a very misunderstood movie in a lot of contexts. I think that now, after literally 45 years, this movie's bonkers. Kind of getting the critical reappraisal that I think is warranted for it. I mean, it's always been something that horror fans have been into, but we'll get into some of the specifics, but I do think that this is a movie worth watching apart from being a fan of the genre. That the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a significant film for a lot of reasons and well worth your time to watch.
Yes.
On that note, we're going to talk about the details of the movie. We're going to run through the whole plot synopsis. So if you don't want anything spoiled for you and you want to enjoy the movie with the maximum amount of surprise, I highly recommend it. If a theater is showing it, go.
Does Gateway do it?
Gateway Film Center here in Columbus does it on occasion when they do their horror stuff.
October, yeah.
Yeah, and most recently, well, I rewatched it again just to get ready for this episode, but before that, the last time I watched it was a month or so ago. We projected it onto the side of my house and watched it from our side yard. It was so much fun. It was so good. yeah, watch this movie. It's great. Now, spoiler warning. We're going to get into the shit now. It is some shit. So turn this podcast off right now if you don't want anything spoiled. And here we go. So, before we get into the plot synopsis, this movie is alleged to be a true story.
You know, from the opening bit. Yeah, that's the thing that it immediately kind of bills itself as.
Yeah.
And it's in like promotional materials as well, but I know that.
Yeah, what do you know about that?
It's very tenuous.
Right.
It's extremely tenuous. You know, it's based on Ed Gein.
Right.
Who did not use a chainsaw.
No, he did not.
The only things that I could really pick out from what I know about Ed Gein, which again, like, isn't a ton because I don't really engage with a lot of that super brutal serial killer stuff, is the bone furniture.
Mm-hmm.
The part when, like, Leatherface dresses as a woman.
Right.
Because Ed Gein was into that or did that.
Right.
And kind of the mask part.
Yes. So, that's good. Because there is a lot more information about Ed Gein, especially nowadays in our day and age of true crime hysteria. We have all these people doing true crime podcasts and books and stuff. You can learn a lot about Ed Gein and any murderer, serial killer, to a much greater extent than Toby Hooper could back in the 70s.
That's very true.
So he actually acknowledges that back then they had very meager, mostly like tabloid sort of writing
about
these serial killers. Yeah. And to be clear, Ed Gein was not a serial killer. He did murder, I think, two people, but his whole thing was digging up dead bodies and using the cadaver skin to create furniture and suits for himself. So not a serial killer, but definitely a weird dude. But yeah, they had very early, heavily sensationalized writing.
Okay.
And that's kind of what they riffed on.
Interesting.
You know, that's the connection to Ed Gein. There's arguably more of a connection to Ed Gein in Psycho or Silence of the Lambs or other films that have been made loosely based on that. I like what Kim Henkel, the screenwriter and producer for Texas Chainsaw, said about this. Sheds a little bit of insight into the killer, the living actual killers that inspired the movie. He said, "I definitely studied Gein, but I also noticed a murder case in Houston at the time, a serial murderer, named Elmer Wayne Henley. He was a young man who recruited victims for an older man, and that man was Dean Corll. He says, I saw some news report where Elmer Wayne said, I did these crimes and I'm going to stand up and take it like a man. Well, that struck me as interesting that he had this conventional morality at that point. He wanted it known that now that he was caught, he would do the right thing. So this kind of moral schizophrenia is something I tried to build into the characters."
Interesting.
Yeah, so I think that that's really significant. You know, this movie alleges to be based on true events, and in terms of the actual killings, that's not very true. At best, there were some tenuous connections with serial killers throughout history, but they didn't have much to go off of. But there's this interesting idea of what he referred to as moral schizophrenia that I do think has a lot more root in reality, especially the reality at the time.
Yeah.
So it looks like the gears are moving in
the
your head.
The gears are kind of turning.
Yeah, so, you know, Toby Hooper even acknowledged that the misinformation of the opening segment, saying that it was a true story, was intentional. That he did want to, like, basically lie about that. That was basically to reflect society. You know, you think about what's going on at the time. You got Watergate. You got all of this new news coverage covering the Vietnam War and how horrible and graphic and awful it is. You had the 1973 oil crisis. Just a lot of situations of people in power saying one thing, but doing another. And that was kind of Toby Hooper's idea. And Kim Henkel, the screenwriter, they both worked off of this idea of saying things to please people, but actually doing things differently. And there being this dissonance between actions and words.
I'm very interested in kind of going back to that.
Okay. So, yeah. Well, we'll revisit that.
Yeah.
Also, a big thing for especially Hooper was the meat industry. And
yes,
he was a vegetarian for a time. I think that might have changed later in life. But that was just another example of that you know, misinformation, as he saw in society, or what he referred to as the lack of sentimentality and the brutality of things. It was just something that was really jarring to him that he wanted to comment on.
So this was something that I had no idea was a part of the movie, was his kind of vegetarian bent.
Yeah.
You know? That was something that you included in, like, a message to me. It was like, oh, he's got this vegetarian thing. And, like, it was kind of a, like a one-off comment you made. And I was like, well, how is that going to happen? You know, like, what is this?
Right.
Sorry
to spoil that and kind of plant that seed in your head already.
No, but it made it really interesting. The hammer kill scene. I'm terrible at knowing characters' names. The guy who goes into the house and then is immediately hit with the hammer by Leatherface.
Yeah, I think that's Kirk is the Kirk. First one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, when Kirk is killed, the pig squealing is happening, like, constantly. You know, and, like, the parallel feels pretty heavy-handed there.
Right.
You know, of, like, oh, this is how you would kill a pig if you were farming pigs and getting ready to raise a pig, you know?
Right.
And I think the movie being set in, like, the 70s, 60s?
Yeah, 70s.
The movie kind of being set in the 70s and kind of dealing with these people who are on the fringes of losing, like, rural life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are the people who would have been still killing animals that they would have raised with their bare hands to eat, you know?
Right.
Whereas America was trending in, like, this direction of, like, I just go to the store and then there's meat in a package and I don't have to think about it. Like,
right.
I don't think about the fact that, like, the chicken that I'm eating is a chicken. And I think that that creates a really distinct parallel between, like, this thing that we look at and go, like, that's brutal. And, like, him being like, well, this is what people are just doing to survive. And if you think that's brutal, maybe you need to consider just walking into a store and buying some pork chops and
right.
eating it, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And we'll get into... I figure we'll go through the synopsis and we'll wrap up with, like, some deeper thoughts on the themes.
Cool.
So that'll give us a chance to kind of go through all the events
Great.
Of the movie and we can
Great.
Come back to that. I did want to point out, Tobe Hooper, creative person that he is, I like the way that his brain works in collecting ideas. He actually had inspiration from a lot of different things in life that led to the creation of this movie. He started working on this movie as basically an updated version of Hansel and Gretel. You know, before there was...
Oh, okay.
Before there was Leatherface or this family in rural Texas, the idea was a Hansel and Gretel remake, and even, like, right down to having trolls and shit in the movie.
Oh, I mean, you could, yeah.
It had a much more fantastic bent early on. In the writing process, and the original working title was Head Cheese.
Sure.
Which comes up later. And Hooper was thinking about a lot of things at the time. One thing was he recalled a story when he heard when he was 7 or 8 years old from a med student who claims to have gone to a Halloween party wearing the face of a cadaver that he removed.
Mm.
And this story just freaked out little Toby. He's like, understandably, that's fucking horrifying. Oh. But that was just an early memory that he could never shake and partially inspired the character of Leatherface. Also, I love this story that Hooper told in an interview where he was stuck in a department store. And I guess it was really busy and he was just, like, trapped in a crowded store. And he said that he kind of rack focused onto the hardware section where there was a pile of chainsaws. It was like the chainsaw section. Huh. And his immediate thought was, well, that would be a quick way to plow through the crowd.
Huh.
And that was something that occurred to him. I guess that happened while he was working on this Hansel and Gretel movie. And that, he said, just prompted this...
Kind of evolved the idea.
Like, that was enough to kickstart this whole creative process where he says he wrote Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Hinkle in, like, one day. Just all of the ideas started coming together from all of these different places in his subconscious. And that's where Leatherface was born and all of the ideas for Texas Chainsaw.
And you can kind of see that Hansel and Gretel seed in it.
Yes.
Where, like, there's some kids and they're lost and then there's some misguidance and there's, like, a trap and...
Right.
You know, you can see how, like, the central core of that story is could be inspired by that.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. You take all these weird random memories and elements that Tobe Hooper talks about, and just somewhere in the middle is like, yeah, it totally makes sense that this is the kind of movie that you would make.
Yeah.
That's how I feel anyway. So I'll read the plot summary of the entire movie.
Sure.
This is from Wikipedia. And Max, you just feel free to interrupt if you got a burning thought about a particular scene and you want to jump in and say something about it. I'll say a few things too.
Sure.
Here we go. Sally Hardesty, her paraplegic brother Franklin, and their friends, Jerry, Kirk, and Pam, visit the grave of the Hardesty's grandfather to investigate reports of vandalism and grave robbing. Afterwards, they decide to visit the old Hardesty family homestead. Along the way, they pick up a hitchhiker.
Do not like him.
No. The hitchhiker talks about his family who worked at the old slaughterhouse. So that's kind of the beginning of a lot of the meat industry elements.
Yeah.
He's talking about how, oh, they don't do it like they used to. You gotta run up and hit them in the head.
Which, ironically.
Yeah, that comes up later. The hitchhiker borrows Franklin's pocket knife and cuts himself, then takes a single Polaroid picture of Franklin for which he demands money. When they refuse to pay, he burns the photo and slashes Franklin's left arm with a straight razor. The group forces him out of the van and drive on. They stop at a gas station to refill their vehicle, but the proprietor tells them that the pumps are empty. So that's kind of our setup and a little bit of an inciting event. A lot going on here with this wacky hitchhiker.
Yeah. When you see movies like Cabin in the Woods, it like is almost beat for beat Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Sure.
In the setup, you know, because they roll up to the gas station and the gas station proprietor is like, oh, I wouldn't go to this place. You know, he's like out of gas and stuff like that.
Right.
The hitchhiker thing I did not know about. I actually wonder, that is very similar to some events that happen in a Raymond Carver short story.
Okay.
Who is just a short story writer. But there's a guy who does Polaroids in it. And I wonder, is like, that was kind of, Carver was releasing short stories around the same time. And I was like, I wonder if that's lifted from like a Carver thing.
Huh. You know? They were contemporaries?
Yeah, Carver was like 50s, but.
Oh, okay. The Carver story might have happened first. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, but it's really kind of an interesting thing where like, you could see how if like Tobe Hooper read that and then was like, that's kind of a cool angle, right. You know?
Throw that one more thing in there.
Yeah. I did not like the hitchhiker. Whoever plays... Did anyone in this movie ever do anything again?
A little bit, yeah. The guy who plays the hitchhiker, Edwin Neal, weirdly enough, he's actually an extremely successful voice actor. And there's...
Okay.
There's some... like giant robot anime where he did 20 different voices in one series. So he's really accomplished. And a few of the actors went on to do acting. Gunnar Hansen, the actor who plays Leatherface, he actually was a poet and
really
acted in this movie for a little while. And I think he's had some little roles in movies, but he just went back to writing poetry. And like, that was his primary passion. But the just being associated with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was a resume killer.
I believe it, yeah.
Like, there's a really good episode of The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs where he talks about how he's interviewed almost all of the cast and crew, or all the filmmakers for this movie, and I guess for all of them, it was really hard to find work. Despite the movie being really successful, it was like, oh, you were associated with that? I'm sorry, we're going to go with someone else.
Yeah, and I imagine for the Edwin Neal, is that what his
name
was?
Yeah,
yeah. I imagine that like he would just immediately be typecast as like crazy hitchhiker number two, you know?
Right.
Just like unhinged, because he does a really good job of just being like kind of dangerously unhinged.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a very unsettling scene. And I do think that it's worth noting that hitchhiking was way more common in the 1970s, like even leading up to the 1980s. Yeah, this
is, I mean, you would be like hitchhiking to like Woodstock or something like that, you know?
Right. But there's a really good Freakonomics podcast episode. It came out in 2011 that talks about the decline of hitchhiking. And it is around the 1970s that started to decline. And a lot of people point to Texas Chainsaw Massacre yeah. as being a driving reason for that. And understandably, if this is the only thing you see with a hitchhiker, you're like, I'm never doing that. I'm never picking up
some I'm never doing that again.
And, you know, like, poking your head through the screen door, I guess, was a much more common thing back then, too. Just, there's a lot of behavior that nowadays we're like, don't fucking do that. That back then, it was, like, a little more common.
And it's interesting, kind of, how the hitchhiker and the homestead as a whole is kind of the insidiousness of rural America.
Right.
Like rural America being viewed as, like, the fringe of society and, like, the fringe is where weird stuff happens, and this hitchhiker is on the fringe, and he kind of like entreats them to come more into the fringe.
Yeah,
and I don't know, it's a very interesting kind of insidiousness to his character.
Yeah, definitely a big trope that was starting to shape. Yeah. In that time period too, I think The Hills Have Eyes came out like the next year.
Okay, yeah.
There's a lot of that. Like, just don't go out in the middle of nowhere and go into the homes of strange people. Also wanted to note that a gas station running out of gas, the first time I saw it, I was like, what? Running out of gas? This was the 1973 oil crisis, where this was a pretty common and understandable occurrence where a gas station would literally not have any gas.
Yeah. And you see, like, would be empty. News footage of, like, cars, like a line four blocks down the street of cars waiting to get gas.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's notable, too, that this setup is so cliche now because of this movie and how famous it got. But back then, this is a very, like, just entrenched in reality. All of these things are, like, touch points on what real life was like.
Like, you would pick up a hitchhiker.
Yeah.
You would.
Run out of gas.
If you got unlucky, you would run out of gas and the place would be like, oh, we don't have any.
Yeah. So from the rip, this is a very, in a weird sort of way, realistic movie. This is not like the Universal Studios horror and the stuff preceding this, where it was just this very big romantic production and you saw the monster very early on in the movie and it was like this big crazy music is playing. Yeah. This is a very different setup. So, moving on. They continue toward the homestead, intending to return to the gas station once it has received fuel. When they arrive, Franklin tells Kirk and Pam about a local swimming hole, and the couple go to find it. So you get your first instance of a couple of teens trying to go out on their own to do a little messing around.
I was like, what a weird, like, you don't get any indication about how long Franklin has been paralyzed for.
Yes.
And I was like, what does Franklin know about?
Yeah, that is a little unclear. And we'll talk about Franklin a little bit more later.
I feel bad for Franklin.
Yes. So they stumble upon a nearby house. Kirk calls out for gas, entering through the unlocked door while Pam waits outside. So they hear a generator. They know there's gas there.
Yeah.
I love too, just that little subtle thing. You hear the and you know, the movie's called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Watching this for the first time, I imagine you're just like, shit.
That's dramatic irony. Cause you're like, you know what's about to happen, but the characters don't, you know?
Yes, absolutely. All of a sudden, Leatherface, a large mute man wearing a mask made from human skin, suddenly appears and kills Kirk with a hammer. Pam enters soon after and trips into a room filled with furniture made from human bones. So we talked about the Ed Gein connection and the furniture made of bones. Let's talk about taxidermy real quick.
Okay.
The production designer Robert Burns, I guess, literally drove around farms and backroads of Texas to collect animal carcasses and bones.
Really?
And I don't know how, but he secured two human skeletons to use for this shoot.
Interesting.
And the armadillo was just from his own personal taxidermy collection.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of these same pieces were used in the movie The Hills Have Eyes a couple years later.
It makes sense, yeah.
So, Max,
uh-huh.
You are an owner of a few pieces of taxidermy.
I am.
Most recently, thanks to Lux Taxidermy. You have
from a fan.
Yeah. Thank you, Brittany, for the shrunken fox head. So, are you offended by the use of taxidermy to scare the shit out of people in this movie?
not Not particularly.
What do you make of, like, the use of that and how she's literally tripping into a room filled with bones?
I mean, I thought that the thing that... Maybe this is just me, but, like, owning things like that, I was like, oh, the thing that they're really trying to freak you out with is, like, the fact that they've made furniture
right
out of this stuff, you know? Like, it's more than just people having some taxidermy pieces.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is so much deeper than you would have ever imagined, you know?
Right.
So I don't really have a lot of beef with it. It is a weird thing. Like, I imagine people will walk into my house and be like, oh, that's a fox head. That's a fox. I'd be a little weirded out by that, but...
Yeah, okay. Well, I was trying to rile you up, but you kept your cool, so...
Nah.
Way to go. You stayed calm and collected. Damn. Anyway.
There is a scene I'm going to get really, really riled up about.
Oh, okay.
Because it made me feel really weird, actually.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Pam attempts to flee the house, but Leatherface catches her and impales her on a meat hook.
That was rough.
Making her watch as he butchers Kirk with a chainsaw. Jerry heads out to look for Pam and Kirk at sunset. He sees the house and finds Pam still alive inside a freezer. Before he can react, Leatherface kills him. With darkness falling, Sally and Franklin set out to find their friends. As they near the neighboring house and call out, Leatherface lunges from the darkness and kills Franklin with a chainsaw.
That is the scariest part to me.
I was going to say, I literally rewatched the movie last night to get ready for this podcast. I've seen it so many times, and that part literally made me jump out of the couch.
Well, I think that's kind of where the most effective, like, documentary style camera work, and the whole thing is kind of like a pseudo, it feels very documentary, and I think it's probably because they were using not the nicest cameras and stuff, you know?
Sure, that might be the case, but I mean, they definitely did want it to be like... The cinematography is very intentional in some points. Like, yeah. You think about that iconic shot. It's kind of like looking up Pam's butt.
Yeah.
But it's a very like well done pan of the camera as she's like walking up to the house, and the house is getting bigger and bigger and kind of engulfing her. There's a few shots that I think are very intentional and deliberate and well constructed. So I don't think it was necessarily amateurish because they didn't know what they were doing. I do think that there was an intent to mirror a lot of like what they were seeing from the Vietnam footage and make it that look very jarring and violent, because that was, you know, it felt more real and terrifying.
That way. I think that's what makes the Franklin scene really effective, is like that chainsaw starts going and then it doesn't stop for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So for 2 minutes you are dealing with like this really grating, oppressive noise. And then also, like, she's running through these thickets and, like, she's getting caught and you can't really see what's going on.
Right.
But her, like, hair is getting caught in the branches and stuff like that. And it's... Oh, that was a rough...
Yeah. It's a long chase sequence.
Yeah.
I also love, I guess, a couple producers were literally standing on either side of... of Paul Partain, the guy who played Franklin. They were literally standing there spitting Karo syrup out of their mouth to create the the blood spray. And little note, just again, just how brutal this shoot was. The Karo syrup, I guess, was just really attracting mosquitoes.
Oh,
and
God.
So in all this heat and sweat and like the actors not thickets. Changing their clothes over the course of a 5-week shoot that's supposed to depict a like one day in the life of these teens, like, it's nasty. It's just, it's gross. It's miserable for everyone involved.
This was also the scene too where I think Leatherface's muteness is most effective.
Yeah.
Because I was actually reminded of in No Country for Old Men. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
The
It's really funny because I went back and listened to our Thing episode.
Do I talk about it there too?
Yeah, you talk about No Country for Old Men a lot.
I love that movie.
It's a great movie.
But the department store shootout scene. Or not the department store, but when they're shooting out, they're shooting at each other in the street, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Javier Bardem is like silent the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, I remember seeing interviews about Javier Bardem, about his role in that movie. And he's like, I think that's what makes something really terrifying, is like this relentless, unstoppable, single-minded evil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think having Leatherface not make any noise, but just be this like force of nature.
Yeah.
Moving unencumbered through these things and like thickets. That's what's really freaky, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the only sound on the screen... it's just that loud-ass chainsaw. The sound design is so incredible in this movie, too. So jarring.
Yeah.
Ugh, just not a lot of music
in
this movie. Just a lot of, like, lizard brain activating, like, awful sounds.
Yeah.
By the way, with how brutal this shoot was, I guess everybody just hated Paul Partain. Again, he's the actor who played Franklin.
Oh.
Paul Partain is a Vietnam veteran who did a lot of stage acting, and I guess he didn't really know that you could just stop being your character out of takes. It was much more like stage acting practice to be full method. Like
method, yeah.
Yeah. So he was basically Franklin all day, every day during this miserable ass shoot.
Push him around.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was to that extent, but he was just that attitude, like very whiny and needy, and the entire cast hated him because he just committed to that personality and that role the entire time. And Marilyn Burns, who plays Sally in particular, could not stand him and would literally not talk to him
outside of
takes. So I love
the character you're supposed to be rooting for.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know if you're rooting for Franklin. I think
popular opinion
is that a lot of people really hate Franklin, but everybody loves Sally.
Yeah.
Which, like, you know, it's the classic horror trope of, like, cast a very, like, pretty girl as the lead and get people to sympathize with her. But yeah, it cracks me up because that scene before they're chased in the woods and Franklin is murdered, you can see Sally, like, losing her shit at Franklin. And what I think you're really seeing is Marilyn Burns lose her shit.
Like, not even
Paul
acting.
Partain. Yeah. there's a few key moments of that, and we'll talk about some more, where it's just like, I don't even think they're acting anymore. I think it's just natural reactions to all this shit going on in this shoot. But Franklin gets murdered. This marks the final kill of the movie, actually.
Yes.
What's your general take on the teens? And I know this is kind of a prototypical cast, and a lot of horror tropes are based on, like, these teens going to a rural house. And do you think it holds up? Do you think that there are parts that age well, that don't age well? What's your general kind of feeling?
So by this point, 'cause I'm actually very interested in what comes after, directly after the scene, the dinner scene.
Yes.
I'm so fascinated by the dinner scene.
And we will talk about that.
But up till now, you know, it feels pretty rote, but like, it makes sense, you know, like, it is very beat for beat to like Cabin in the Woods and like that whole thing.
Cabin in the Woods is beat for beat Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah. But it is remarkable when you don't see like the foundational work in a genre and then view it and go like, oh yeah, that's what everything comes from, you know? That's what everything is pulled from.
Right. Yeah, there were certainly other influences, and I mean, you mentioned Hitchcock. That's certainly something that continues to impact horror storytelling. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pivotal, primitive versions of things that were riffed on so many times since. Only thing I want to say is, like, all right, let's tally it up, right? We've got Franklin, who's a paraplegic. He's like completely insufferable and like the most hated character in the movie, maybe. You got Gunnar Hansen, who played Leatherface. He says that he took his inspiration from mentally disabled people for his horror villain. And then you got Edwin Neal, the hitchhiker, acknowledging that he modeled his character after his paranoid schizophrenic nephew.
Oh.
He did give the qualifier that his nephew was never violent.
Okay.
Which is a nice
Sure.
You know, nice thing to grant, I guess. I did want to take this moment, not to get too woke and shit, but, like, if you write horror, if you're listening to this and you create any kind of horror, I think that there is a huge opportunity for different and more nuanced depictions of people with disability or mental illness.
Uh-huh.
This is where a lot of those tropes start.
Yeah.
It does suck that, you know, if you are disabled or mentally ill, you are either a villain or it's just a completely insufferable piece of shit.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of any examples in horror off the top of my head of, like, you know, sympathetic characters who, like, you're rooting for who are, you know, disadvantaged or disabled. And if you can think of I'm sure that there are exceptions out there somewhere, but I would love to hear about them. If you got any recommendations, predeadboys@gmail.com, message us.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting thing.
But yeah, along with this prototypical cast and, like, where a lot of these tropes start, that's just one that I'm like, I would like to see, you know, a little more nuance and different things done with characters.
Yeah. I feel like there was a big rash in, like, the mid-2000s of, like, kind of Stepford-esque things where it was like, ooh, now the suburbs are scary.
Right.
That, like, Shia LaBeouf movie Suburbia
was
a thing. But then I think probably that genre kind of peaked with Get Out, you know, where that was, like, the apex of, like, affluent white suburban people doing evil, scary things. You know?
Well said. Okay. Not to belabor the point, we can move on. So Sally runs toward the house. She finds the desiccated remains of an elderly couple upstairs. She escapes from Leatherface by jumping through a second floor window and flees to the gas station.
Uh-huh.
So she runs for a while. It's wild. The proprietor calms her with offers of help, says, I'm not going to hurt you. Calm down. And then he pulls out a burlap bag and ties her up, gags her with a, like, the nastiest rag I've ever seen in my life.
It's like just an oil rag.
Ugh. And forces her into his truck. He drives to the house, arriving at the same time as the hitchhiker, who is now revealed as Leatherface's brother. The hitchhiker recognizes Sally and taunts her. And now the dinner scene.
So strange.
The men torment the bound and gagged Sally while Leatherface, now dressed as a woman, serves dinner. Leatherface and the hitchhiker bring down one of the desiccated bodies from upstairs, that of their grandpa.
Who is like, alive, right? Yep,
he is revealed to be alive when he sucks blood from a cut on Sally's finger.
Yeah, that was... Now, is he alive when she first sees them?
Apparently.
Okay. Because that was the thing that I was like, wait, what is, like, real at this point?
Yeah, very jarring scene.
Yeah.
And it's definitely shocking when you see him just... The reveal of him being alive when the camera is right up to his finger sucking mouth, just deeply unsettling. Here is the only piece of information that we've been given on that character that lends any amount of insight into this. And I feel like it brings up more questions than answers. Grandpa is 124 years old.
Okay.
So does that kind of help you understand that scene a little?
Sure.
It's bizarre. Now, a lot of people have kind of connected that to,
isn't,
like,
there, like, more lore in, like, the next couple movies or something?
There is, but I have not seen them in their entirety. So
I've heard that it takes, like, a weird, like, necromancy angle.
Yeah. So those were... My understanding is that those movies were not planned by Tobe Hooper. That this was supposed to be a one and done, like, a thing that exists on its own. So, for all intents and purposes, I'm going to watch those at some point. But that lore can be effectively separated from this. But it was noted that he is supposed to be 124 years old.
Sure.
Which is absolutely bizarre.
Sure.
It does open up. Like, I love when there are movies where there's some theories that you can chew on of what might be happening.
Uh-huh.
There's that line that Franklin talks about, people being a bunch of Draculas, a household full of Draculas.
Oh, yeah.
So there's kind of a potential reading into this that they're getting some kind of vampiric life force from eating dead people.
Huh.
I don't know.
But that...
One can imagine.
I just want to talk about the dinner scene, because it was so bizarre.
Here's the rest of what happens there. The family decides that Grandpa, the best killer in the old slaughterhouse, should kill Sally. He tries to hit her with a hammer, but he is too weak. In the ensuing struggle, she breaks free, leaps through a window again, and flees to the road. That's our dinner scene before the finale of the movie.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's talk about it. What do you think?
So the dinner scene is funny.
Yes.
In a very disconcerting way.
Yes.
But it's kind of played up like a 50s sitcom, like Leave It to Beaver style family.
Uh-huh.
Because Leatherface is wearing, it's not an apron, he's wearing like a full dress, right?
I think it was like a suit, but the mask he's wearing is a new human skin mask with makeup and long flowy hair.
Yeah.
So we're supposed to like conclude that he's like the domesticated, like, motherly figure in this weird dinner scene.
Dad gets home from a long day at the gas station and is like very like conventional nuclear family 50s dad,
right?
And then the hitchhiker is like bratty and very teenage.
Yes.
And it's this very uncomfortable, like, sitcom inspired kind of comedic scene, and like the whole hammer thing is very strange, and like I laughed very nervously.
Yeah. But then, you know, there are parts that are scary combined with it too, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what do you remember as scary about the dinner scene, if anything?
Like, just Sally's whole experience of this, and like, I envision, like, in my own headspace, I was kind of alternating between a very detached view of being like, this is very weird, and probably a commentary on like 50s, like the decline of American morality. And like, as you're kind of talking about that thing from earlier,
the moral schizophrenia,
you know, these killers are actually having a very like placid, boring home life.
Right.
But then for Sally to have to deal with this like incongruity in what she's experienced and what she's experiencing now in a very like Hannibal Lecter-y way, where like Hannibal Lecter having this very like brutal style, but also being very highbrow and very like, like when he talks about eating the dude with like fava beans or whatever.
Oh, are you What's talking the about Silence line? Of the Lambs?
In Silence of the Lambs, yeah.
Yeah, I ate his liver with fava beans and nice Chianti.
Yeah, like very like highbrow thing, and the kind of disconnect between that is really freaky.
Yeah.
And I was kind of in Kelly's headspace and being like
Sally's headspace.
And being like, this would be really disconcerting, you know. Right. I felt very disconcerted, and that freaked me out a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
And in the Blu-ray commentary, Hooper says the humor was very intentional, and he was surprised when he saw the movie in theaters that, like, nobody was laughing. Nobody really was, like, at all, like, catching the comedy of the moment.
It is just so, like, Archie jarring. Bunker, All in the Family right. stuff, you know?
Right, and that was part of the reason why in the sequel he really played up the comedy, and it was, like, that's just, like, a completely slapstick movie by comparison.
Okay.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a comedic moment paired with this just abject horror of being strapped to a chair and knowing that you're going to get killed and eaten.
Yeah. In the same way that, like, Psycho has that very, like, the reveal of, like, Norman Bates' mother, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just a very domestic horror thing.
Yeah.
But domestic slasher horror.
Right.
It's really interesting.
Right. Yeah, that paradox is really jarring.
Yeah.
Let's talk real quick about this god-awful fucking shoot and just how miserable this movie was to shoot, because the dinner scene was the absolute worst of it.
It's a very small room.
It's a very small room. This is like one of the most notorious shoots in horror film history.
Okay.
So, set the stage here. The dinner scene, you have Grandpa, right?
Uh-huh.
Grandpa was played by John Dugan. At the time, he was 18 years old.
Oh, Jesus.
Which is hilarious. The makeup was a full body affair that literally took 8 hours to apply.
Oh, God.
And they're running on a shoestring budget. They didn't want to waste time with, like, reapplying the makeup and all this stuff. So he had to sit for 8 hours, and then they had to shoot the entire dinner scene. This is, you know, the accounts differ in how long this scene took to shoot, but across the board, everyone seems to agree it was longer than 26 consecutive hours.
Oh, my God.
This room, they were shooting during the daytime, obviously, because over the course of 26 hours, you're going to get some sunlight. So they had to black out all of the windows.
Oh, my God.
This raised the temperature inside that room to over 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Good God.
And it was so bad that the meat that they used on the dinner table started to cook and rot.
Oh.
So it's hot, 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 hot. It is smelly with rotting meat in this sweltering room. All these stage lights, too. You know, they're lighting the scene.
Yeah, and you're trying to, like, block everything.
Right. The actors literally had to take breaks to go throw up out the window between takes.
God.
Also, this shoot for this movie sucked for all the actors. They all have nothing but miserable experiences to share about the actual shooting of the movie and how brutal it was. But I think it's pretty conclusive that nobody got it worse than Marilyn Burns, who played Sally. She got the absolute worst of it. And this scene, in particular, she literally got hit in the head with the hammer during that scene. There's like a couple points, if you watch closely, you can see
like
she gets decked with the hammer a couple times. It's obviously not enough to kill her, but it's like, she got hurt.
Yeah.
And like, got brain damage from this fucking shoot.
Oh.
Also, they had this rig lined up to her finger that was supposed to kind of like release the Karo syrup.
The blood, yeah.
But it was getting like dried up from the heat and coagulated, I guess, inside the tube. So what they did is Toby Hooper like took the protective tape off of the knife that was used and literally cut Marilyn Burns' fingertip. And so she is literally
just bleeding,
beaten, cut.
Good God.
Jumping out of windows with shattering glass everywhere.
Sure.
Running through these like
thickets,
brambled thickets, and getting her hair stuck in shit. This is like, also, again, Karo syrup. She's drenched in it. She's
mosquitoes.
Sweating. Mosquitoes are going wild. This has got to be like one of the most harrowing experiences for a human being to go through, short of like actually being chased by a killer with
this
a chainsaw.
Actually happening.
Which, by the way, Gunnar Hansen was using a live chainsaw for the entire shoot. And there are only there's a few scenes where the teeth are still on the chainsaw. They were not removed for every scene in this movie.
Oh my God.
This is brutal. So I want to ask you, what do you think of like the physicality of the movie? Because I think you can see the evidence of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of curious, you know, this was your first time watching the movie. How did you feel about like what the characters are going through? Like, how real did any of this actually feel?
It definitely
feel?
Gets... Like, I think currently where a lot of horror is done in, you know, a very special effects-based way,
mm-hmm.
this felt real. It felt brutal. The camera helps, but I think the fact that they're, like, not... Like, she sounds ragged and harrowed by the end of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh, yeah, this is jarring, you know?
Yeah. They're literally sweating their
asses
off. They're going through hell to shoot this.
There are some movies where you can kind of see that it was shot non-consecutively, you know? And I wonder if this was like, was this shot consecutively?
From what I read, apparently it was. At the very least, the dinner scene was shot, and then after that, they shot the final scenes. And then that was the final.
Because imagine just like having to also watch everyone around you be like, all right, guy who plays Franklin, you're done now. You know, like you can go like
go home,
you know, but her having to endure this.
And at the very least, I know that the teen actors did not talk to Gunnar Hansen during production until their characters were killed. So I believe that was in sequence as well.
Oh, interesting.
Which I love any time horror films are shot with that. Like I know the recent It movies, the children were kept away from the guy who plays Pennywise the clown.
Uh-huh.
And so the first time they saw him was like in their scenes where they're getting attacked and all of this shit. So it made for some more authentic expressions of fear when, when they went through the shooting process.
And then you go hang out with him later, and he's, like, very erudite and
right,
probably nice, and you're like, oh, right, huh,
right. Weird. Do you think that this movie was exploitative? Because it definitely has that reputation, at least, you know, when you first hear about it, of being, like, this horribly violent, awful
viewing
movie.
Viewing it with the knowledge that, like, of, like, the vegetarian stuff and the animal cruelty stuff, I think the calculation that Tobe Hooper puts into it helps it not come across like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I could definitely see where America was at morally in the 1970s, being like, this is exploitative.
Right. You know? Yeah. Very scandalous for the time.
Yeah. But then you see a movie where we're at now with, like, Saw or something, or, like, Final Destination. And those movies, I thought, had way less substance and way more just, like, pointless gore.
Yeah.
Like, the worst thing in this is the meat hook scene, I think.
Which you never see a hook go through skin.
Yeah.
The actress who played Pam, she had a harness strapped to her back, and so I guess they just kind of looped a metal ring that was strapped to the harness over that hook, so that nice little convincing, like, drop that you see when she's lowered onto the hook.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of lent to that. But yeah, there's very little actual gore in this movie. The blood that you see is rarely coming out of people. It's most frequently, like, smeared on the walls.
Or and it's very quick. Like the Franklin scene is, like, half a second.
Right.
He just, like, pops out. It's like...
Yeah, and then he's done.
I mean, the Kirk scene is probably the longest, because he, like, is twitching on the floor for a while.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and you see him all, like, bloodied up, his chest and whatnot. For sure. Okay. We'll finish up the story synopsis here. Leatherface and the hitchhiker give chase to Sally. The latter is run over and killed by a passing truck. Leatherface attacks the truck with his chainsaw.
That's very weird.
Sound logic. And when the driver stops to help, he knocks Leatherface down with a pipe wrench, causing the chainsaw to cut his leg. The driver flees. Sally escapes in the back of a passing pickup truck as Leatherface maniacally flails his chainsaw in the air. So, it's the final day of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
The worst filmmaking experience of anybody's life. I guess Gunnar Hansen was so fucking done with this movie, he was literally trying to wave the chainsaw in Tobe Hooper's face at times. And he was like, I knew that Tobe knew that I didn't have good peripheral vision in that mask, and so I was really trying to get it close, like, to him.
Freak him out.
And you can watch an outtake in special features on the Blu-ray and DVD. At the very end, he literally throws the chainsaw into a ditch. Like, he just hurls it up into the sky.
Yeets
like
it.
A petulant kid. Yeah, he yeets the chainsaw. Also, get this. Marilyn Burns was drenched in Karo syrup, eaten by mosquitoes after 5 weeks of the most difficult shoot ever. When she got the call, hey, we didn't quite get what we needed from that final scene. We need a reshoot. So, she gets back in her clothes, drenches herself in the syrup, goes back out in this 100-plus degree weather, hops in the back of the truck, and they reshoot that scene. So that maniacal laugh of relief, the iconic ending of the movie,
she's done.
Yeah. I think, like, any reality in this movie that you see is a little bit less, like, this is the exact story of Ed Gein or some serial killer. And it's very much, like, you see the suffering of human beings on tape in a pretty big way. So we'll skip. There's actually a lot of interesting stories about the distribution of this movie, the money issues it had, and how the mafia plays into that.
Really?
You can look that up on your own.
Huh.
Cause that's wild. But, I guess, Edwin Neal says that his first paycheck for the movie came after 9 months after the movie came out, and it was for $28.
Oh my God.
So they got fucked out of money for a very long time on this film.
Oh.
But that's a story for another time. We should wrap up. What are your final thoughts on the movie? You know, just the themes, the whole experience of watching it. What's your takeaway?
I'm very glad that, again, I'm really glad that I kind of knew a little bit about it going into it. You know, there's like the, you were asking me before if I thought it was exploitative. And there's the Supreme Court line about pornography where it's like, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, I don't know really how to define an exploitative film, but you know it when you see it. And this movie doesn't really strike me as that. You know, like, Tobe Hooper seems like he has a very direct message that he is trying to convey about urbanization and rural life and, like, fringe residency in America, that he is really trying to get that across, whether that's, like, us in urban areas eating meat just kind of in a very detached way, or, like, the disappearance of the, like, nuclear family,
mm-hmm.
and how that is, like, a thing that's almost connected with these, like, freaks that are living in, like, a home in the middle of nowhere.
Right, and kind of living out a parody of that life.
It's definitely, like, a very interesting statement film that happens to have a lot of people that are getting killed by a chainsaw.
Yeah.
Not even a lot of people, actually.
Right.
Like, four? Chainsaw, there's... How many chainsaw kills?
One.
It's Franklin.
Literally, Franklin is the only one actually killed with a chainsaw in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Which, again, goes back to the misdirection and, like, the kind of jerking you around with what is real and what is not that the movie set out to do in the first place.
Yeah, and I think it does, like, the dinner scene is an excellent, like, questioning what's real as you're watching it, and it knocks you out of the movie just enough that when you get pulled back in, it's like, oh god, right, I forgot about this.
I'm glad that you see it that way. I'm glad that it wasn't... I felt a little bit like, what did I get Max into by making him watch this movie? I know he's not the biggest horror fan. But I'm glad you see it that way. I just love that, like, there is a lot to chew on in this film. And I think in particular, like, the way that Tobe Hooper created a film that made people rethink what horror is.
Yes.
And horror is not a genre in and of itself. You know, like we talked about last week with Mary Shelley and how science fiction that she was writing was very different from the fantasy that was created at that time. Like, this was a work of its time that, like, it wasn't this big operatic sort of horror story like Creature from the Black Lagoon. It was
birds.
Shocking. Yeah, it was shocking. It seemed real and not, like, constructed. It felt very jarring when Leatherface appears and bludgeons a guy to death out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's something that's done to death now, like the based on a true story horror movie. But back then it was very reflective of, like, people are realizing that they've been kind of lied to with what the meat industry is and what Vietnam looks like and all of these things.
Well, we talk about that in war photography, where, like, people weren't willing to look at what they had caused, you know?
Right, exactly.
And this kind of seems like people in cities are not willing to look at, like, rural America, you know?
Yeah.
That seems like a lot of what we're dealing with now to a degree, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This was a movie that kind of force people to take a harder look at things that were uncomfortable. I think it's really valuable for that reason. Beyond it being an entertaining and crazy movie, I mean, I'm certainly entertained by being scared and the jarring things that happen in it. I think it's an important movie for a lot of reasons and definitely worth watching, even if you're not a fan of the genre.
Yeah, it feels like it owes a lot more to Psycho, in, like, the same way we watch Psycho as, like, a highbrow horror film now, than it does to, like, Saw.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm always going to have a soft spot in my heart for the real schlocky, just, like, bloody mess kind of nonsense horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
This is a very different, like, much more intentionally crafted thing from start to finish.
Yeah, absolutely.
But very cool.
Yeah.
It's late, man. You should kick me out of your house. We should probably wrap this thing up.
Okay, get this puppy wrapped.
I just want to say real quick, again, this is a little bit of a preview of the sort of thing that we want to do every month. So head on over to patreon.com/predeadboys and just take a look and see if you'd be down to support what we do. We would love to give you more little bonus episodes like this. But
we can suggest some things to make me watch.
Yeah.
To make us both consume.
Hey, you can make me watch some stuff that is worth us talking about too. It doesn't have to be one-sided.
I love The Thing, man. That movie's so good.
Yeah, it rocks. But yeah, we would like to do more stuff like this, so head on over and consider throwing in your support financially, but whether or not you do that, we appreciate your support by listening. Absolutely. And doing everything you've done up to this point. That's an awkward way to phrase it. I need to go to bed. Max, you got anything else?
No, I was just genuinely very impressed by how this movie subverted what I thought it was going to be. Thought it was very cool.
Awesome. All right, thanks a lot, guys. You're gonna rot, etc.
You know the drill if you're supporting us.
The drill?
Driller killer. Watch that one.
Ooh, yeah. Bye.